Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the top-tier brewing stand. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Aloha.
Good morning, Brew Strong.
Oh, good morning, Brew Strong.
I mean, it has the right cadence to it.
Yeah, I like greetings, cretins.
Well, you know, that's
you.
Yeah, that's nice and easy. You know, did I ever?
You in
I probably didn't tell you that.
What?
I got the nice and easy award when I was in college from our little sisters in
from
the
sorority.
Yeah,
that's great. Your wife doesn't listen to this show, does she?
No.
All right.
The upside of having a wife that isn't really interested in beer.
The nice and easy. Mr. Nice and Easy. That's what we should call you. Mr. Nice and Easy. That's your new nickname. Nice and nice and easy. John N. E. Palmer. Well,
anybody needed help on their homework, I was the guy.
You were nice.
And easy.
And where's the easy part coming? Anybody needed port in a storm? a little late night action after going out drinking? You were Mr. Easy at that point?
Yeah.
Let's use the nice guy.
Yeah.
He'll probably be easy.
Yeah.
John gave new meaning to the word cramming. As needs some help studying, ladies. Let's do some cramming.
Yeah, I'm sure our fine sponsor, John Blickman, BlickmanEngineering.com.
He knows all about cramming. He's a smart guy.
Yeah, I'm sure he's college educated.
Yep.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, he wants to be educated even more by our wonderful listeners. He's asking. He's going to be doing it. Not that he needs any education, but he is going to be doing a presentation at the
NHC.
Yeah, in Minneapolis this year, 2010. And he is doing a tips and tricks to set up your own home brewery. And, you know, he got thinking about all the tips and tricks that he could give out. And, you know, he could go on and on about all the great ideas he has for improving, you know, the brew day, but he also wanted to get you know, the listeners involved, and he wanted to get your feedback as well and ideas you might have, and make this not just Blickman's, you know, prescribed way of brewing, but, you know, great tips and tricks from everybody. And he realized that you know, you guys out there are pretty creative and clever, and would have some great tricks and techniques and you know, anything for organizing, designing, planning, your brewery layout, making your brew day more pleasurable, and getting more efficient. So, if you have any smart, cool ideas for organizing your brewing area, let's say, you know, space is an issue, or planning your brew day, shortcuts for cleaning, sanitizing, things like that, send them to NHC2010@BlickmanEngineering.com. So NHC and then the number is 2010 at BlickmanEngineering.com. So I want you all that are listening to send at least one or two ideas you have. Even if you think, oh no, this is so simple, everybody's thought of this. This is, you know, when I did the Whirlpool chiller, I'm like, well, this, you know, why hasn't anybody thought of this? This is pretty simplistic. You know, nobody else is, you know, why hasn't anybody thought of this? Apparently some people had, but nobody was talking about it. So it turned out to be a handy idea. So, you know, I'm sure you got ideas like that as well. Even just a, you know, anything. No matter how simple, you should go ahead and
send them to John Blickman, and he'll compile these and present them at the conference and to lots of people that are interested in the same kind of ideas.
Mm-hmm. And while you're at it, thank him for sponsoring the show. Blickman Engineering, you know, make all the fine equipment. Well, they're peeling off the bucks every show to make sure that you don't have to pay for this. They're taking care of the tab for you, so the least you do is send them a thank you and check out their gear at blickmanengineering.com. Go to a local brew shop and say, hey, you know, you carry Blickman Engineering gear, and you know, check it out. Anything from that sweet, revolutionary beer gun, which we'll be talking about in a future show, to, you know, their top-tier systems. John, you're brewing on top-tier system. What was the last thing you brewed?
I did a Vienna on it.
Ah, very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, good beer.
Well, then you must have got the recipe from Brewing Classic Styles.
I did, as a matter of fact. I mean, started out. You know, I can't make the same thing twice, so I always got to mess with it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
So even though it was a genuine Jamil recipe, I had to turn it into a Palmer recipe.
Okay. Well, that's what's important, that you enjoy your brewing day.
Brewing's fun.
That's a chance to be creative. That's what I love about it. Well, it's a chance to be geeky, too, and that's part of what this show's about. And,
that's right.
Justin, do we have a topic for today?
We do have a topic today. I hope I get it right this time. Brad Jerkins from Ames, Iowa, wrote in, and he wrote in about making a yeast library. It's something that's come up before. He says, Jamil and crew, I've listened to almost every episode of Brew Strong, and I like to think it's really improved the quality of my beers. Feel like I have the basics down now, and I'd like to try my hand at some more advanced projects. One thing that's really interested me lately is yeast storage. I like the idea of being able to have a library of any yeast I want anytime I want it. Slants, plates, distilled water, glycerin, what's the best way for long-term yeast storage and propagation?
Good question, and one that's near and dear to my heart.
You're the yeast whisperer these days.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I maintained my own yeast library for quite a long time, and then I kind of let it go, and I found a few new interesting strains that I'm really interested in, I think, maintaining myself, especially now that yeast book's done. It got me real fired up about improving my yeast lab a little bit more and being able to do some more advanced storage. So let's start here. John, give me a definition of, what's a yeast library?
It's a collection of slants or plates that you have gathered from commercial beers or commercial breweries or previous fermentations that you felt went particularly well. Mm-hmm. And these slants or plates can be kept refrigerated and kept for quite a bit of time.
Mm-hmm. And so, but why do this? What's the whole purpose? Well, can I just go out and buy whatever yeast I'm going to use? I go out, pick up a pack of Y yeast or a tube of White Labs, and I'm off and running? No?
No.
Okay. if you say so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeast is it's a living organism. Uh-huh. It adapts to an environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yes, you can go out and buy, you know, Y yeast and White Labs and get, you know, strains, you know, real good strains from commercial breweries and for particular beer styles. Mm-hmm. But, you know, let's say, well, whenever you do that, though, you're not getting just a type of yeast. You're also getting a particular strain of that yeast. Mm-hmm. So if you're let's say you're getting German Hefeweizen yeast, and let's say you've cultured that from a bottle of genuine German Hefeweizen, it's going to be subtly different from the same variety of yeast from, say, White Labs or Y yeast. Mm-hmm. Because it was grown under different conditions. It was harvested at a different time. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of drilling down to another level of detail mm-hmm. in your brewing. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, brew with yeast off the shelf, or you can say, I really like this example of this style, you know, mm-hmm. particular brewery's example of a style, and say, I want to clone that beer. Mm-hmm. And so the best way to do that is to culture up their yeast, because that is going to, you know, that's going to get you the farthest along to matching the yeast character of that beer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's also thousands of yeasts out there, right?
Right.
And you can't buy all of them, you know, at any given time. You know, White Labs, Y Yeast, and any other yeast suppliers only giving you a small slice of their entire portfolio. There are, you know, other yeasts out there that, you know, there's just not enough interest in the broader market maybe for those to be offered, you know, year round or at all. And maybe you get your hands on one of those strains, and then you know, you want to be able to brew with that. You'd need to, you know, add it to your library so you'd have it available. All right, let's do this. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we can get into, you know, the equipment you use and stuff like that. Right, back after this.
Brew right. Brew smart.
Brew strong.
This is Brew Strong.
When Blickman Engineering set out to design a great brewing stand, they knew it had to be strong, adaptable, and last for a lifetime. The top-tier brewing stand is now proudly available at BlickmanEngineering.com. It grows with your brewing skills and equipment. Start with 5-gallon coolers on its heavy-gauge stainless steel shelves. Then move all the way up to 30-gallon pots on the high-output burner tiers. Speaking of burners, the custom Blickman Engineering top-tier burners are extremely powerful, efficient, and amazingly quiet. They have safety stops to center your pot, and they'll last a lifetime and won't rust. The top-tier brewing stand allows virtually infinite combinations from traditional gravity systems to two tiers to completely horizontal. Configure your stand the way you want and have the freedom to change it at any time in the future. Your brewing stand should adapt with you, not force you to learn a new process. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com today to configure your top-tier brewing stand and to find a local Blickman retailer. You'll be surprised with all the flexible features and the competitive price. Start brewing with Blickman from the top tier.
Downtown Joe's, located in the historic Oberon Building in beautiful downtown Napa, California, offers an award-winning brewpub experience from 8:30 a.m. to 1 a.m. every day. For 15 years at the corner of 2nd and Main, Downtown Joe's has been voted Best Night Spot 7 times and Best Brew Pub for the last 4 years in a row. Brewmaster Colin Kaminsky's handcrafted ales, like his Tail Wagon Amber Ale and Catherine the Great Imperial Stout, are the perfect accent to riverside dining, live music, and a relaxing outdoor patio. Don't miss the Beer of the Month, special rotating taps, and happy hour all day Mondays. Visit downtownjoes.com to make reservations, peruse their extensive calendar of events, or just read more about their fantastic beers. Come enjoy the fine beer, food, and music. Downtown Joe's, the award-winning brew pub where you'll feel at home.
Where were we?
You stole an oak barrel from the mists of Ravenwood, and Lord Zinfandel the Avenger is in pursuit. Do you drop the barrel and run?
Hell no.
We need it for a Flanders Red.
I'm going to cast Pediococcus Damnathus on the barrel.
Sorry, your ghosts are imprisoned in his winery forever.
Ugh, I hate it when Greg's the brewmaster.
This sucks.
What do we have here? Orville Rodenbach?
Buzz off, guy. We got a brew session going.
Is that an actual beer?
Yeah, I crafted it. I don't really use the dice anymore. I'm a 10th level beer nerd.
Are you a 10th level beer nerd? Do you get a long-lasting foam stand when you think about wheat malt? Then you're in good company at Northern Brewer. Northern Brewer has all your beer nerd needs, ingredients, equipment, and knowledge at northernbrewer.com. Plus, fast, cheap shipping, only $7.99 for the contiguous USA. And check out Northern Brewer's huge selection of dorky beer kits, including the pre-prohibition lager.
Perfect for steampunk.
And the single hop best bitter.
Now on cap and 10 forward.
Make 10th level at northernbrewer.com.
Ewa, what's it feel like?
Take awesome and multiply it by two.
Yeah!
Spraying live beer radio all over your face.
Can't get any better than this, baby.
It's the Brewing Network.
Like the Lance Armstrong of the beer world. Except for that nut thing.
This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking yeast library. So let me recap real quick. The library is a long-term storage of yeast cultures, right, John?
Yep.
And then the purpose being, the why is, well, you can have on hand cultures that you can use for your brewing that you may not otherwise be able to get commercially, or they've mutated
right.
over time and you particularly like it. Maybe it's a yeast you've developed from your own backyard and you want to work with that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, in many cases you may be you may brew a particular style, you know, one of your favorites. And you've taken California ale, for instance, and repitched it several times, and you notice that you get, you know, a unique fruity character from your repitched yeast that you don't taste in your friend's beers that use Cal ale. You know, so you've evolved and mutated, you know, Cal ale to your home brewery. I mean, to your style, and it's become a unique. Offshoot of Cal Ale, or a unique strain of Cal Ale, and you want to keep that and be able to repitch that same state of that yeast over several batches. If you keep, you know, repitching, like harvesting the yeast cake and repitch that and repitch that, it will continue evolving. But when you take a sample of yeast cake and store it on a slant, now you've kind of stopped its evolution process, and you can build up a starter from that slant, and perpetuate a single strain, you know, of a one spot in time in the evolution of that yeast.
Now, what about the equipment you need to do this? How extensive is the equipment?
Well, it's all readily available. It helps to have a small gas burner, a Bunsen burner. You need a selection of petri dishes or test tubes. You need some agar. What else?
Inoculation
needles.
Loop. Yeah,
inoculation loop. You make out of stainless steel wire or other wires.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. Okay. Or am I missing anything?
Well, that's basically it. So you have these slants and plates are used to. They're filled with agar and malt extract media, right? And you use these to grow up the yeast on these in individual colonies, right? So you're starting
right.
out with. One of the things you need to do is ensure that you're working with pure culture techniques in order to kind of isolate the cells you're working with. It could be helpful, I guess, to have a microscope, hemocytometer, things like that, if you want to do cell counts and maybe you know, check viability. You know, you'd have some stains as well.
Tell the folks what a hemocytometer is. Is it a big machine with lots of vacuum tubes and
yes,
electronics?
Yes, that's what it sounds like. it's just like a slide with a little chamber on it, or two chambers on it, that are divided up into these microscopic little grids. And they use it for counting blood, you know, hemocytometer, right, for counting like blood cells and stuff. And you...
So it's a little glass slide with a grid on it.
Yeah, and you just you dilute your yeast down to a certain concentration, a certain approximate concentration, and then you let it you let the yeast travel up underneath the into the to fill the counting chamber. And you look at it under a microscope, and you count the number of cells in the different grids, and then you multiply out times whatever dilution factor you did, and that tells you how many cells you have in your yeast slurry. That's how you determine like cell counts in a given pitch of yeast. But it's useful also. You can look at the you can even do it without a hemocytometer with slides, and you can do staining for bacteria. You can do staining for viability, things like that. So it's kind of handy. Yeah. And you could buy the all this equipment for doing this yeast culturing pretty cheap. You can buy pre-made slants and plates. It's nice if you can do it yourself because, the pre-made slants and plates that I've purchased haven't been of the best sterility. Anytime you buy some, you'll want to set a couple out in a warm environment, room temperature, or, if you want to incubate them, between around 80 degrees for a couple of days and see if anything grows on them. If so, then the whole batch is suspect. And if you make them yourself, you want to do this as well. If you're going to make them yourself, you're going to need essentially an autoclave in order to sterilize the various media that you're going to use.
Okay.
And and you buy pre-sterilized plastic plates and slants and things like that, which make it a little easier, cheaper. Let's see. All right, so that's essentially the equipment. Stuff that you'd also need stuff I guess that you're going to grow your yeast up in, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to need smaller flasks or vials to do little mini starters as you're growing the yeast up in quantity as well.
Yeah, and all of this equipment is available from like More Beer and Northern Brewer and a lot of the larger homebrew shops, right?
Right, absolutely. And it's pretty common stuff. So pricing's not too expensive. You could get started with this pretty cheap. It's nice to have a little test tube rack as well, for your slants. Makes it easier to, instead of a bunch of slants rolling around. When I was doing this, you quickly end up with, 60 or so tubes. And, if they're just all rolling around, it's a big pain. So you put it in there. Now, if you really want to get into extensive long-term storage and you want to do freezing or something like that, then it's better to get yourself like some little cryo tubes or some little micro centrifuge tubes. And microfuge tubes, they call them, and like a 1.5 mil or 2 mil, and use those to store the yeast for freezing. And if you get a centrifuge, if you have access to one, that's nice also because you can do a little bit more efficient storage by getting rid of the spent wort. And
it's too bad they don't make centrifuge attachments for your washing machine. Yeah, something you could hang some test tubes from inside and then hit the spin cycle.
I imagine you could. The trick is getting it balanced.
Yeah,
it depends on how many RPM it is. But the lower the RPM, I think the less you have to worry about killing somebody with pieces flying off.
And so just the lid. Yeah.
And the farther away from the center point of the where it's spinning, the more gravity, more G's you're pulling anyway. So at a lower RPM. You don't need a really high RPM if you're further out from that center point. And you only need, what can you stand? What, 1,500 G's, I guess? Something like that. That's your max, which is really pretty low. Those little cheap desktop centrifuges that you can find on eBay, just about any single one of them will work. Because as long as it spins and it'll hold the tubes, it'll work because you don't need a lot of force to get the yeast to settle at the bottom. You don't want to use too much force because you can kill the yeast as well. So if you're going to freeze some glycerol and pipettes, things like that. It's still pretty reasonably priced. You really don't have to. And we'll get into that more when we get into the individual storage.
I'm thinking that I should tell John Blickman to come up with a centrifuge unit that you can attach to your Makita.
Your Makita, yeah. You know they still have hand crank centrifuges. I mean, that's how centrifuges started. There was like a mechanical crank with a couple arms that raised up. You know, you'd hang your stuff on the two balanced arms, and then you'd turn this crank, and just like a hand drill, and you know the thing would spin and centrifuge. And they still have those, and people use them for I don't know what they're using them for.
Egg beaters,
making butter. I don't know. Anyways. So that's a possibility. All right, let's continue on here. Getting sidetracked. All right, so where do you get the yeast that you're going to put in your library? You kind of touched on this, but what are the possibilities?
Well, you can get them from commercial beers that you really admire. Some cases, if the beers are filtered, there's not going to be much yeast to harvest. But in bottle conditioned beers, mm-hmm. or you can often find. A layer of yeast on the bottom that you can harvest from. The thing to be aware of is that quite a few commercial breweries that bottle condition their beers use a different yeast strain for bottle conditioning than they do for their main fermentation. Mm-hmm. So you may end up getting just their priming yeast culture rather than their house yeast culture,
right.
But check their website. They'll often talk about that, or check mm-hmm. the forums. People often know about these things, and can fill you in.
Well, and that brings up a good point. I think that you want to any yeast that you're going to use, if you're going to store it and all that, and commit batches of beer to that strain, you're going to want to do some test fermentations first before you do a larger batch. So, make yourself up a liter of wort and do a small fermentation with that, and check to see how well it attenuates, whether it flocculates, as much or as little as you want, and that the flavor seems appropriate to what you're expecting. If it doesn't, so like John said,
check for contamination too.
Right, you're gonna have to ensure the purity of the yeast. One of the things that a lot of people do when they start getting into the idea of making their own yeast library is, I can go ahead and bank all the yeast that I can get from White Labs and from Y Yeast, and I'll have all these on hand. I don't need to buy yeast anymore. Sure, in theory, you could do that. A couple of problems. One is, the more yeast strains that you decide to store, the more labor it is. Maintaining a strain of yeast is labor. It's not just, store it, throw it in the fridge, and then a couple years from now I decide to brew with it. It's all ready to go. Not quite. At warmer storage temperatures, you're getting more mutation. So in the fridge, you get a mutation. The commercial yeast manufacturers, they store theirs in a minus 80 C refrigerator. So, the yeast are, there's very little mutation over time. Anything warmer than that, the warmer it is, the more rapidly mutation is going to occur. So, that's one of the issues. The other is, when you store things, the yeast that cold, you're going to get some die off, and you need to reculture these things. You need to grow them up. You need to do test fermentations, make sure that they're still fine. Especially if you're going to store on plates and slants, you're going to need to reculture these every few months to make sure that you still have a healthy, decent strain, and it's not mutating off in some weird way and not making the beer that you want later on.
Yeah,
so,
yeast ranching is not about just sticking it in the closet or sticking it in the back of the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. It's this is a whole other hobby practically.
Right. Yeah, it absolutely is. That's a good way to put it. You'll give up brewing several batches of beer at least in order to you know, maintain, you know, a handful of cultures. So what I did initially was I did that very thing. I was like, well, I'll just, you know, bank all these yeasts. And when I quickly realized, it's like, wow, what a huge amount of work this is. And why am I doing this when the yeast labs are, they will, you know, they actually, you know, reculture it, and they have very specific performance requirements. And they make sure that the yeast you buy, you know, that you bought last year, you'll get the same fermentation performance from it next year, you know, 5 years out, 10 years out, when you go out and buy one, it's exactly the same. If you're to store your own yeast, you have to put that work in to ensure that next year or 5 years or 10 years down the road, you're going to get the same performance out of it. And if you don't do that work, there's a good chance that you won't. So that's one of the things to look out for. So what I like to do is only focus on the strains that are very difficult to obtain. So strains that aren't commercially available, strains that I've collected that seem unique and I can't find a matching one commercially, those are the ones that I want to maintain. Now, you know, maybe a gray area is like the platinum strains from White Labs or the VSS strains from Y Yeast, where, you know, they're only available, you know, once every few years or, you know, once a year. That might be one that you want to store if you know, if you can't get it regularly. Again, you know, and the nice thing about that is you're starting from a pure culture. You know, you can be pretty darn certain that the yeast that they're providing is nice and pure. So let's say we're getting a yeast from a, let's say I have a bottle of beer from somewhere, and boy, the yeast character seems really unique, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, I can't buy this commercially, and I want to store this yeast. What's the process, John, that I go through to ensure that I have the right yeast from the bottle? I mean, there could be multiple strains in there, or there could be, you know, some contamination in there, like you mentioned earlier. How do I ensure that I've got a pure culture that I'm going to store?
Well, this is where you take your equipment, your inoculation loop, your plate, mm-hmm. and you take all your clothes off and run around with the yeast on the plate. Yeah, you streak the yeast on the plate. And and look at it under the microscope, and look for, you know, single cell colonies. I mean, or, you know, colonies that are homogeneous. Mm-hmm. And this is where the microscope comes in handy, because by looking at the plate, and to backtrack, by streaking,
smart gay yeast.
By streaking the yeast on the plate, what you're doing is you're taking your inoculation loop or your needle and drawing a line across the agar mm-hmm. with the yeast. Mm-hmm. And you'll put a drop of yeast on the agar and draw a line with it out across, and do kind of fan out several lines of the yeast mm-hmm. and let them grow. And you can look at these yeast on these streaks under the microscope and look for homogeneous cells. Mm-hmm. You want them to be uniform shape. You don't want any small, you know, petite mutants, they're called, mm-hmm. small cells. You want cells that look uniform, look healthy, look plump. Mm-hmm. And those are the healthy cells that you want to, you know, harvest and start a starter from to mm-hmm. grow them up to it, to, you know, to brew with.
Right. So you know, there's a couple of techniques on the slants and streaking the plates, and the purpose is, so you'll see, you know, putting a drop on a diluted drop of yeast culture, not a thick drop of yeast, but it's diluted. You put a drop of that water there with a few cells, and then streak them out in that fan shape, or you can dip your loop in something, and then you run it back and forth in a zigzag pattern. Then you rotate your plate 90 degrees, do a zigzag pattern, going across some of the lines of the previous pattern. Then you do it again and run it out. And the whole purpose of this is that you end up with individual colonies grown up from a single cell of yeast. So you want those single cells spread out so far apart on that plate in the end that they have room to grow up into full colonies of yeast, which have, you know, a million or a billion cells or whatever it might be. And you can start seeing those colonies appear. And when they grow, colonies with dents in them, colonies that look shiny or slimy, odd-colored ones, and colonies that so you may see your average-sized colony. If you see some that are smaller than others, like John's talking about, that was perhaps growing up from a petite mutant cell, and it has a respiratory deficiency, and it's not able to grow as well as a normal cell. So those colonies will be smaller. You don't want colonies that were, gotten too big or too small. You want the nice, average, consistent, creamy-looking, good round shape to them. And those are the colonies grown up from a single cell. So that's a pure culture technique. And you would harvest that. And, if you're not sure that the yeast you've collected is going to produce the flavors that you're looking for, you harvest that, you grow that colony up in, 20 mils of a starter wort. And then you step that up to a larger size, maybe 200 mils. You grow that up, and then you do a small test batch of beer, a liter, a couple of liters of beer, and see if the flavors are what you're looking for. And if that's the case, you can go ahead and then use the result of that as you can plate that out again, and then use those cells to. For your storage purpose, you can store them on the plate, or you can store them in other ways. And we'll get into that in a bit. But that's kind of how you ensure the purity of what you're storing is by isolating them out into single cells on the plate, and then testing that, making sure that it's correct. And that's how you ensure that you're not mixing a bunch of bacteria or wild yeast or multiple strains. Now, sometimes you might have multiple strains in a beer, and that's why that beer tastes that way. And one of the things you'll want to do in that case is select multiple colonies off that plate. Randomly select 10 and do 10 test batches and see if they all taste the same. Then chances are they all look the same and they all taste the same. Chances are, and all the colonies on the plate look the same. Then it's a single strain. If you're getting wildly different tastes, then, these are, it's a mixed strain, and we've got multiple yeasts here. And then you'd have to decide, banking them both or, what you might do at that point. And anything to add on ensuring purity of the culture that we're storing?
No, honestly, I was wondering to myself what Bub and Blobberglop would think of all this, these procedures that we're rattling off, the streaking, the turning, the et cetera, et cetera. I just have a feeling they're taking this the wrong way.
The important stuff.
Yeah.
They're confused. How does my streaking have anything to do with yeast? I got that cleared up with medication.
Yeah.
All right. So... and again, selecting the yeast that we want for storage, like I was saying, once you've done these test batches and you're sure of what you're actually storing, that's part of it. And picking the colonies, like John was saying, you're looking for those weird shaped colonies. If there's a dent in them, you also don't want to select two colonies that are adjoining. That can be an issue as well. You want a colony growing up these pure culture techniques. And actually, if you search the internet, search Google and look up pure culture technique, It's actually, you'll find a bunch of stuff on Pure Culture Technique. It's been around a long time.
Yeah, it's the old quality in, quality out, you know, thing. You can, using these techniques, mm-hmm. you get better quality. You decrease the chance of contamination in selecting and growing up this yeast.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what Hansen used to isolate the first lager strains. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, kind of revolutionized things, development of pure culture techniques and applying that to the yeast, and allowed people to, you know, be more selective in, as what they're putting into their beer and using to ferment beer. Before it was, just scoop out a bunch of yeast, you know, throw it in there, and, you know, you're getting everything, including bacteria and all that. And until before that, you know, people were drinking beer that, you know, had some souring to it probably. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, with that invention, it's like a really cleaned up beer. So you essentially need to do the same thing if you're going to maintain your own yeast. One of the nice things about working with, you know, the remnants of a smack pack or a vial is, you know, what's in there is quite pure already. So, yeah, if you were to just go off of that, I think that's okay. You know, you could pitch your package of yeast and then, you know, take your loop and dip it in there and then streak it out on a plate, and you know, that's good for at least a little while, you know. Well, and that brings up my next question for you, John, is how do the storage what are the various storage methods? Let's kind of cover that first. What's the common ways of storing yeast long term?
Refrigeration helps. Mm-hmm. It helps slow down the metabolism of the yeast. When you're doing an agar plate, if your sanitation is good and your sterilization is good on a plate, the yeast will survive on that agar plate for about a month. That's at room temperature. Refrigerated temperature. If you really seal it up well, you know, and protect it from oxygen, it may keep up to a year. You go from the plate to a slant, which is like a test tube, you know, you improve the storage life by 3 months refrigerated as is. And then if it's really sealed well, 1 to 2 years.
Well, and one of the things about these storage times, again, one of the reasons that, you know, the commercial labs are able to store their yeast for long periods of time and not have them change is the storing of minus 80 C. The warmer, the big problem with a lot of these storage methods, because I see people on the internet, they're like, a slurry of yeast, and I used that 2 years later, and it was fine. Oh, I got plates that, you know, they're good for, you know, 5 years down the road. Oh, the yeast is fine. It's like, well, you know, you may still have living yeast in there. And like John's saying, if you seal up your plates or your slants, you can use vinyl tape. I like to use, electrical tape. It comes in many colors, and it's great for sealing up plates. Or you can use parafilm, which is what the labs use, but it's like a heck of a lot more expensive than vinyl tape.
It's like a wax tape kind of thing.
Yeah, and a stretchy sheet. But, you know, vinyl tape, you can buy it down at, you know, your home hardware center, and, you know, you can use that to seal up the edges of a plate, and that plate will stay nice and moist for a long period of time. But the problem is, you know, as those colonies grow, they're mutating. You know, mutations will occur over time. So that's, you know, the drawback. You will have living yeast, but you can't really be sure that it's the same yeast that you started with. And that's why colder temperatures are better and certain storage methods might be better.
How are we doing on break time, Justin?
It's always break time to me. But if you mean for the show.
Yeah.
What you need to feed the cat, shake the dog,
yeah.
And have a beer. All right. Well, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll get more into storage times. Back after this.
your carboy cap on.
This is Brew Strong.
We'll be right back.
Do you support the Brewing Network? Do you brew your own? Are you looking for an economical, fun, and legal way to do both? Subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine and do just that. All year long, Brew Your Own will surprise you, entertain you, and educate you with articles on beer and brewing from authors like the Brewing Network's very own Jamel Zalishev and John Palmer. Each issue is a full pint of brewing techniques, homebrew stories, tips and photos, projects to make yourself, and recipes for the avid home brewer. Get your tough questions answered by Mr. Wizard, and polish your style accuracy with Jamel. A portion of every subscription goes to the Brewing Network, so subscribe today at BYO.com/Brewing Network or just click the BYO logo on the Brewing Network homepage and support a fantastic hobby and your favorite broadcaster. Brew Your Own, the how-to homebrew beer magazine.
Hey, what are you doing, man?
Writing a review of WLP 400.
What? You're reviewing yeast?
Yeah. White Labs has home brewer reviews of all their strains. Are you new to these interwebs? Check it out.
That's awesome.
White Labs, your source for great yeast, invites all brewers to visit whitelabs.com to read and write your own reviews of all their yeast strains. Get real-world tips and tricks from other brewers who have made the most of their vials and post your own experiences. It's another way White Labs brings you closer to the best yeast on the planet.
And send. There you go. You misspelled flocculate, dude.
What?
White Labs. It's all in the vial.
Hi, this is Push from the Brewing Network, and I want to tell you about the Brewmaster's Warehouse and how you can get 10% off your next order. I'm a pretty techie guy, but I've never seen an online store like this. It's awesome. Go to brewmasterswarehouse.com and click on Brew Builder. You can whip up a custom recipe so easily even Sven could do it. Seriously, it's slick. You can share your recipe with your own logo and notes to the Brewmaster's database if you want. And the best part, it keeps a running tally of the beer you're building while you're doing it. Then, bam, click Buy Recipe and your cart is filled and ready to go with helpful suggestions in case you forgot something. This thing is amazing. Brewmaster's Warehouse is run the way a home brewer would do it, with great service, fast turnaround, and $6.99 flat rate shipping. Brewmaster's Warehouse and the Brew Builder blew me away. Check it out today at brewmasterswarehouse.com. I'm serious. And don't forget to put BNARMY in the discount code box for 10% off your order. Check out brewmasterswarehouse.com. Cheers.
BNARMY members, are you looking for a discount on hops? Keep listening. Nico's Homebrew Supply at nicobrew.com has hops by the ounce and by the pound. Choose from varieties like Amarillo, Centennial, East Kent Goldings, Holler Tower, Simcoe, Summit, Tomahawk, Warrior, Willamette, and more. And adding new varieties all the time, many for less than $20 a pound. Whether a couple ounces at a time or an 11-pound bag, all hops are shipped vacuum-sealed and frozen straight to you. Nico's Homebrew Supply offers store-wide $5 flat-rate shipping and won't waste your money on unnecessary overhead or advertising. They're going bare bones and passing the savings on to you. The staff at Nico's Homebrew Supply loves to brew and is committed to keeping homebrewing affordable and accessible to anyone who wants to join in this great hobby. And for a limited time, use coupon code BNARMY at checkout for a Brewing Network discount. Visit nicobrew.com. That's N-I-K-O-brew.com for your hops and more. nicobrew.com, your bare bones buddy in the brewing business.
This year, More Beer wants to introduce you to some of the amazing staff that bring homebrewing innovation home to you every day. This month, Concord showroom manager and award-winning brewer John Plizé is here to tell you about the top five gadgets he can't brew without.
Number one, yeast starter. So crucial to have active, healthy yeast going. Decreases lag time, you have a healthier ferment. Number two would be our oxygenation assembly. Oxygen is really important for cell growth for your yeast. Third would be a Servomyces. It's a zinc source that your yeast need for a healthy fermentation. Fourth would be a wort chiller. I really enjoy the counterflow convoluted chiller. It's compact and gives me the best control as far as cold break. Fifth would be the More Beer conical, the new improved one with the sealable lid. It's pressurizable. You can inline filter. It's got a tri-clover lid on the top. You can repitch your yeast. It's got a huge blow-off tube. The functioning of this new More Beer conical is far superior.
All of John's favorites are on sale this month only. Hurry to morebeer.com or visit the Concord Showroom for the best innovations and people in home brewing. Morebeer.com.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking yeast, long-term yeast storage, or building a yeast library, and long-term storage is part of that, right?
Right.
You were saying earlier with a slurry, you know, if you keep reusing it and you keep it healthy and all that, you can go ahead and brew with it, but you're going to get mutations. If you're trying to maintain, a yeast that's providing you great fermentation character, exactly what you want to store that as mutation-free as possible over the longest period of time possible. So, you can,
and that's where these techniques come in.
Right, right. So we were going through various methods for storing. You've got your slurry. You could put them on a plate, and if you seal it up, like you're saying, it's going to last longer. Still, you know, mutations is a limiting factor in any of these, because I've had plates where there's, I think I got plates that are like 5 years old, and there's still living cells on there, but I would never think of using it for brewing. Slants are a little bit better because they tend to be sealed better. Stabs is where you have a slant. And a slant is like a test tube full of the malt agar. They let it solidify at an angle, so you got a broader surface in the tube, and you put your yeast on that. You seal it up, and if you're buying test tubes, the ones with little gaskets in the seal are better, you know, with the screw-on lids, and then you can always put a piece of tape around that or parafilm around that to exclude air from it. A stab, you're just taking your cells and jamming it down into the some agar in a tube. You do it standing straight up, so it's a flat surface on the top. But usually you do stabs for growing things that grow without oxygen, and it can increase the life a little bit more because it's not going to grow as fast without the air there present above it. And one of the interesting things, when we were working on the yeast book, I don't know if everybody knows, but I was working on a yeast book with Chris White, White Labs, and I was looking into some of the stuff that I haven't really messed with a whole lot, which was water immersion and oil immersion. So I think it was Hansen, many years ago, he made some cultures and in test tubes, and what you do is you remove all the sugar, all the stuff that they can use to grow, all that the cells can use to grow, right? Any other materials. You just pure cells, you rinse them nice and clean, centrifuge them, rinse them, and then you store it in water.
Sterile.
And right. And then he stored these cells on a bookshelf next to the window. The sun would come in during the day, and it would get cold at night, and the seasons would change, and, you know, it gets really cold where he's at, and, you know, really cold in the winter and warm in the summer. And 14 years later, there were living cells in that culture. And you're not talking a huge amount of cells. You're talking just a tiny little drop of yeast cells. You barely see it, barely visible at the bottom of the tube, and then, you know, a few mils of the sterile water. And so there were living cells in there. The problem with this is, you know, certain cells will break down, and then that's food for the other cells, and, you know, you might, again, you might get some mutation as well. So, but water immersion would be one. And so by limiting nutrients, you know, the plates and the slants provide nutrients to the yeast because they're made with the wort sugars, right? And that's part of how they grow on those. By not giving them nutrients, they're actually more stable. They can last longer.
I was thinking we should expand on that a little bit. You know, because yeast are a living organism, they're very adaptable. And they try to, you know, yeast really try to adapt to their environment.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're pitching to a particular style of beer and you're repitching that yeast, you know, the yeast are doing their utmost to evolve and adapt to, you know, to reproduce as well as they can in that environment. Same thing when you're trying to store them for long-term storage. If you give them, you know, a small set of resources to work with, they will try to adapt to those resources. And that's where if you're storing the yeast in beer, you know, you're just kind of pouring off some yeast slurry at the end of fermentation and a lot of beer mixed in and some dead yeast cells and so on. And you're storing it cool, but you're not really, you know, keeping it really cold in the refrigerator. You know, the yeast are going to try to adapt to that environment, and they're going to mutate. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about mutation, is that they're going to, you know, undergo some real changes to try to cope with that environment. The more you can do to isolate them from nutrients and from oxygen, the more they'll stay the same. There won't be enough, you know, nutrients and resources for them to make any changes. Mm-hmm. You know, they're more stable that way, and that's where the agar and the low temperatures come in, is that we're trying to really minimize the environmental stresses on the yeast and keep them as stable as possible.
Now, probably one of the best storage methods is making a slant and then putting a sterile mineral oil, covering enough mineral oil to cover the slant. No, so no matter what angle it's in, it's the yeast are always under mineral. And what that does is prevents the oxygen from getting to the yeast, and it actually extends the shelf life as well, and mutation-free shelf life as well. And then I read up on desiccation, and you can actually take filter paper, and you put the yeast slurry on there, put it in the fridge, and it sucks out. You know, the fridge is a real low moisture environment, and sucks out all the moisture, and you end up with this dried yeast. And the problem with that, some people, you know, claim long storage times, you know, 3 to 6 years. The problem with that is that process actually encourages mutation. So not considered a really good way to store your yeast. And then professional frozen, they can store those indefinitely. That's minus 80 C or minus 112 Fahrenheit. But the home freezer, I think that there's something to be said for the home freezer. Now,
do you have to use the oil immersion method with a slant for home freezer to get the water out?
No. What you end up doing for the home freezer is, you can use, glycerol. And
is that the same as glycerin that you can buy at the drugstore?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you want to use a food grade glycerin, just to be sure. you never know what could be in otherwise. So you're going to need a sterile glycerol. You need some sort of like a broth solution, and you need your little microfuge tubes. A centrifuge would be good, though it's not really that critical, I guess. Some pipettes, and what's good is a small styrofoam box. And ascorbic acid, that was another one that can be helpful. So what you essentially do is you grow your pick a colony and you grow it up in 10 mils of a media for 48 hours. And one of the things you're doing is your growth is done before that, but you're letting the yeast sit in there for the 48 hours to let them build their glycogen reserves at the end. Mm-hmm. And then you move this culture to about 40 degree Fahrenheit, 4 degrees C, refrigerator temperature. And you hold that for another 48 hours, and then that allows the yeast to build their trehalose content, right? again, for storage.
Right. That's the Trelos is kind of like the fur coat of a bear when it goes to hibernate. It really helps them protect them against stress. Glycogen is kind of like the fat reserve, and the Trelos is a kind of a stress protector.
Mm-hmm. And then so then you'll resuspend the 10 mil culture. You shake it back up, resuspend. You know, fancy lab term. Shake it back up, get all evenly mixed, and then you're going to pipette 1 mil of that to one of these microcentrifuge tubes, right? 1.5 mil or 2 mil, right? And you can centrifuge this for 3 to 4 minutes, and then you'll have liquid on top and a little pellet at the bottom. You decant the liquid, and you're going to replace that with when they're doing commercial freezing, they use 15% glycerol and 85% YPD solution, and that, and then they'll resuspend it, and that's what they'll freeze it at 80°C. For the home freezing, now this I found really, really interesting. There's some recent research, and I guess there's maybe the way to do it is not to freeze the yeast. Because once you freeze the yeast, it's, you know, the freezing does damage some of the cells. Mm-hmm. And if you can increase the glycerol to 50% concentration, you actually, at the minus 20°C that you may have in your regular fridge or freezer, right? Mm-hmm. The yeast won't freeze. And one of the problems with using your own fridge freezer is that it has those freeze thaw cycles that frost freezer has.
Right.
But if it doesn't freeze, it's not a big deal. So by using a higher glycerol concentration and not freezing the yeast, they can withstand these swings. It won't kill the yeast off. Yet you're still getting the benefit of minus 20°C. You're not. It's not minus 80, but it should be, in theory, far more less prone to mutation than, you know, at 4°C or, you know.
How much time are we talking here? Like a couple of years?
You should be able to get a couple of years. It's going to depend on your
how well you prepare.
Yeah, how well you prepare things and the condition of the yeast to start with. You can add also 1 gram a liter ascorbic acid into the solution, just a little bit in there, and that will also prevent oxidation of the yeast, I believe. So there's all these interesting little tricks for possibly storing this. And then you put these in you put all your cryotubes in a styrofoam box, a small styrofoam box. You could make your own. Just make sure to seal it up well. You could make it out of, you know, some sheet styrofoam from whatever you get, and you put that in your freezer, and that actually helps slow down the cooling and the warming of the cultures. So it keeps them a little more stable. You don't want to freeze them excessively fast in this case.
Okay,
and that works. Supposed to work really well. So, I haven't really tried this new non-freezing method. So, I'm excited to give it a try. So I actually got myself a new centrifuge because my old one was points up. So,
does your wife know you have that?
I don't know. You know, I got it. It came. I opened the package and jammed it into the lab area before she could see it.
Smart man. Yeah. That's a man who's been married for a little while.
yes. But I'm sure she walks by and she's like, someday she's going to. So what's that thing? Centrifuge? Been there a long time.
Yeah. Someday she's going to walk by the lab with a calculator and start adding up all the little devices you have.
Well,
people gave that to me.
Yeah.
eBay is your friend for this stuff. You can get this stuff if you're aggressive. But the centrifuge, the kind of centrifuge I have, it's a little more pricey, but
You do a lot of your shopping on eBay, though, right? For different equipment and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Always you find good deals.
You can do really well. I got a great microscope off of eBay for under $200. I mean, you know, it's like $1,000 microscope.
That's amazing.
You know, it's perfect condition. So, you know, especially now, a lot of labs are being closed out, going out of business and stuff. You get all sorts of great stuff at reasonable prices. Shipping is usually what kills you on this lab stuff because it's heavy.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's see. So this is some of the storage methods. And, you know, don't worry if we're going kind of fast through this because it's a very detailed, complex process.
And Chris White's book's coming out.
That's right.
When is it coming out, Drew?
This book will be out this fall. So
this fall.
We sent it off to the publisher in middle of February. And I've yet to get back the technical review, but we got a great technical review guy too. I'm real excited about that. And then we'll go through that, any touch-ups we need to do, and then it should be there by GABF.
Oh, sweet! So you can look forward to this book.
You definitely hunt down Chris White at GABF, have him sign the book, and I'm sure Chris will be at. Going to be at the Brewing Network anniversary party in Minneapolis?
I think
so. Well, that's in June, though. We won't have the book then.
Yeah. Yeah, you won't have it by then. That's
true. Following year.
Yeah. Maybe there'll be an official signing at GABF this year, though.
Right.
Could happen, right? Because it will be out by then.
Yeah, we did that for Brewing Classic Styles, which was a lot of fun.
Maybe you can get a shirt signed by White at NHC.
Have him sign your breasts.
Yeah.
Yes.
There you go.
I still remember what the third day of our signing when... You know, the predominant question of people coming up to us was, hey, where's the bathroom?
was that the question? And we did get a couple of people that asked that, didn't we?
Yeah. That third day when it was like kind of like, it wasn't the beer geeks. You know, it was just the general public. They'd never heard of us.
Yeah.
I get that sometimes too. Sometimes people just fucking with me. At NHC last year, during club night, a lot of people wanted photos.
Uh-huh.
And finally, sort of toward the end, this couple of guys come up. They go, hey Justin, can we get a photo? And I go, sure. And then they hand me their camera and turn around and pose. It was great. I loved it.
That's never happened to me.
Yeah, that one's a good one.
Yeah,
I like the where's the bathroom one too. That one's good.
All right, so so a lot of this is detailed. There's every last bit of it is detailed in this upcoming yeast book. So if you got questions, a lot of stuff you can find on the internet for free. A lot of this information is out there. It just takes some, you know, searching around. Hopefully we've given you all the keywords you need to kind of find some of the details of this. There's a lot of good images and detail on, you know, making plates and slants, both pouring them and how to streak them out, how to choose colonies. You know, pure culture techniques. Again, you know, you search for these phrases and you'll find the information you need. And then these yeast storage, a lot of this freezing yeast and things like that and yeast storage times, it's not in just wide open information. It's more, you know, research papers. So those are a little harder to come by. But, you know, you should still be able to find a lot of those techniques. Ted Hausstatter, I think he did... a nice presentation at NHC in Cincinnati on freezing yeast. And a lot of good information in there. And I actually talked to him about this and the latest. And he's the one who pointed me to this research paper on not freezing, just using higher glycerol. So I thought that was really cool. Let's see. All right. So we've got our yeast stored either on plates or slants or oil immersion, or we've gone to the sterile water or freezing. And we want to start up. I want to brew. You know, let's start discussing the techniques of, you know, how do I start this up? Let's say, you know, I guess it would really matter, you know, whether you've stored it for a short term or a long term. Would you say, John? Or
yeah, in general, you know, you're looking at standard starter techniques where you don't want to drown the yeast in a starter. You know, you can't take an inoculation loop and dip that in a 1 gallon starter mm-hmm. and expect to get lots of yeast out of it.
Right. You get some growth, but then instead of growth,
how do you find
really,
them?
instead of growth, what you're really getting is fermentation.
Yeah.
At some point, you've provided it so much that it's never going to grow past a certain point. It's just going to ferment what it have. And you're making beer. You're not growing yeast.
Right.
Okay, so a short storage then, if I've stored my yeast on a plate for, you know, less than a month or, you know, something like that, but you pick a colony off, you throw it into, I like to use these 50 mil transfer vials, so screw top, the blue. If anybody remembers what White Labs used to sell their yeast in, those are transfer vials, 50 mil transfer vials, and they got a screw on top. You can burn a hole in the top with a hot paper clip,
mm-hmm.
covered over a piece of parafilm. That's how I do it. And then you put 20 mils or 25 mils of wort in there. You pick your colony, toss it in there, shake it up, and then that'll grow. You take the results of that, add it to 250 mils of wort. That first step, I suggest, especially if you've been doing shorter storage, it's not as big a deal. But the longer your storage time, or if you're trying to grow yeast up from a bottle, something like that, use like a 10-20 specific gravity wort, about 5 Plato. Don't use the more concentrated normal starter wort. You want a gentle, transition for the yeast. And and then go up to your next step. You can go up to, a 1040, around a type of 10 Plato wort for your starters. And then grow up there. And again, you can, you go in steps. You can do a factor of 10 or whatever it is to get up to your starter sizes. One of the things that people ask me all the time is, well, how do I know how many cells I have after, when I pick a colony off and grow it up in? You know, it depends on so many factors, I can't tell you. You're going to have to learn to estimate, yeast densities and get yourself a microscope and a hemocytometer and count them. That's the only way you're really going to know. On the longer-term storage, a couple issues. One is, viability is lower, so the health of the yeast is probably lower and maybe more difficult to start up. Again, important to use a lower gravity starter wort for that. The other is mutation, right? Mm-hmm. Long-term storage. So you would, you can grow some up, and then you might want to plate it out again to, using pure culture techniques, pick individual colonies, do a quick test ferment, and make sure that, what you're growing is, it seems right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same. It's kind of the analogy of a starving man. He hasn't had food for a long time. You don't give him a feast to start with because he's just going to puke it all up. You got to, start out slow, give him a little, real simple foods, and let them get their health back before you really, start feeding them and get into massive reproduction.
So all their reserves are depleted. Their cell walls are, they may have trouble, holding back the sugars and things that are, outside the cell. And if put them in highly concentrated wort, the osmotic stress can be detrimental to the yeast. So you want to give them a chance to kind of build up their energy, so to speak, like John's saying, before you give them a richer diet.
Right.
Okay. So
so you sort of recap. You said that you start from a plate or a slant with your inoculation loop, and you transfer that to, 25 milliliters of wort?
Yeah, you can go anything from 10 to, 35 mils, I guess.
Okay. And then after that's grown for how long?
It depends on, how long that was in storage and the health of the cells. Generally 24 hours, it's pretty much done. There's no more growth after 36 hours.
Okay.
If you want to wait 48, they build up their glycogen reserves and they do that whole thing. But, you know, I wouldn't really wait more than 48.
Okay, so 24 to 48 hours, right. And then transfer it to 250 milliliters?
Right, right. About a 10x step. Now, one of the things that you can do if you have a shaker table, you know, you can't really – it's hard to do they do have stir bars, actually, for the beveled tube bottoms. That's why these transfer tubes and all that, they have these beveled bottoms. You can drop in specialized stir bars in there. You could put it on your stir plate even. But if you have a shaker table, you can set this on there, and that also helps with the growth.
Shaker table, that's a washing machine, right?
Right, exactly. Well, unless you're like me and you go on eBay and buy yourself a shaker table.
Okay.
You know, you can use that to suspend these, you know, smaller versions that are a little harder to do on a stir plate. Once you get up to a certain size. And if you don't have some way of doing that, what you want to do is pick it up every, you know, as frequently as you can and give it a little shake, give it a little shake, give it a little shake. And it will help with the growth and the procedure that you're trying to grow that yeast with. And that, you know, if you do that very often, you know, it'll help a lot. So if you don't have a shaker table or stir plate, you can always go that route.
Yep. Okay.
And if you are harvesting yeast from one of these frozen cultures, you know, there's a couple of ways you can do it. You can pull out one of these microfuge tubes. You can warm it up in your hand. You can warm it up in a water bath. You want to warm it up pretty much as quickly as possible. And then you can just take the entire contents and dump that into your wort that you're starting it up in, or you can you know, reach in with a, you know, a pipette and pipette out like a, you know, a tenth of a mil and drop that in, and you know, that will get you going as well.
Okay. And so at what point do you transfer this, you know, built up slant to a regular starter? After the 250 mil stage, or do you go
right? See, and that's a question a lot of people ask me. At what point is it equivalent to, you know, White Labs vial or a YE smack pack? And it depends on, you know, so many factors. But generally, when I do it, I'll do you know, a off a plate into about 25 mils, then I'll do 250, and then I'll do a 2 liter. And at the end of the 2 liter, I'm pretty close to most of a vial or a smack pack. Especially if you're doing a stir plate, then you know you get considerably more growth. Then you're
okay.
You're
when you're at a 2 liter, do you pour that directly into a regular starter, or do you chill and decant? You know, are we going to concentrate this yeast at some point?
Yeah, I like to, if I can, you know, chill it in the fridge and let all the yeast settle out completely, give it a couple of days, and then decant the spent wort, and then, you know, add more starter wort. And I'll keep doing this until I get to the right, you know, volume that I need. If I'm trying to grow a lot of yeast, I'll separate out some of that yeast and I'll set it aside as storage, and then I'll use a small portion to grow more yeast.
Okay. So you're not doing this, you know, slant to pitching a couple of days before brew day. This is a two week long process.
Yeah, you got to give yourself at least a week, I think. Depends on how much yeast you need to grow. The you know, you grow this yeast up, and the thing I like to do also, once I get it up to the size I want, I've got all my yeast and it's brew day, and it's sitting in the fridge, I can decant off the spent wort. I add more fresh wort the morning of my brew day, you know, about 4 or 5 hours before I'm going to pitch the yeast. And I don't add enough to like grow it again, but I add like a pint or so of starter wort. And just get the yeast active before I pitch it, and
get a kick,
you know,
yep.
Yeah, you get a really great fermentation with that. And you know, the point is lots of, you know, the appropriate amount of healthy yeast grown up, pure culture techniques, you know, a nice sanitary environment, and then you know, get it nice and active before you go, and you know, fermentations will do really well. So but that should get people pretty close.
Okay.
But
all right.
You're never really going to know unless you count the cells. You know, that's you know, it's tricky. If you want to know what yeast concentrations look like, actually, you can take this is something I figured out when working on the yeast book. We're trying to figure out ways of teaching people. People always ask about yeast densities, and I was thinking about it one day, and I'm like, okay, well, wait, all right. Here's a vial of White Labs yeast. If I shake it up, okay, that's about 3 billion cells per milliliter density in there. That's what a 3 billion per milliliter slurry looks like. If you take that out and you add, you know, water to it, you know, to a certain volume, I think it's they're around 37 mils or something, you add it up to like 50 mils, it's like a 2 billion density. And then, you know, you add 50 mils water more, and you're at 1 billion per milliliter density. And those are the kinds of densities you get with slurries, generally. So, you know, that can be pretty helpful. And then also, I discovered this turbidity thing, where if you put yeast in distilled water in a clear glass container, and if you add yeast to the point where it just goes from looking perfectly clear to just slightly turbid, where you can actually see that there's something in there, that's a million per milliliter, I believe. So it's just barely visible. And that's the kind of pitching rate that they use when they do re-inoculations of beers. Anyways, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get into some questions from the chat. Back after this.
Brew right. Brew smart.
Brew strong.
This is Brew Strong.
From the stovetop to a camp burner to some kind of brew stand, most homebrewers follow some version of this progression. With each move, a homebrewer will often have to change a lot, if not all, of their equipment. Until now, Blickman Engineering brings you the top-tier brewing stand, the only brewing stand that grows with you. For example, buy a top-tier floor-standing burner now, and it'll bolt right to your top-tier brewing stand when you're ready for all-grain brewing. The top-tier brewing stand is perfect for 5-gallon to 20-gallon batch sizes. Its modular design is adjustable and accommodates everything from small footprint coolers up to 30-gallon pots. How does the top-tier brewing stand do it? At its core is a strong, heat-treated, and anodized aluminum main post. On all four sides are built-in T-slots for the adjustable heavy-gauge stainless steel shelves and beefy burner tiers. The tiers accommodate any manufacturer's pots or coolers up to 21 inches in diameter. Best of all, not only does the top-tier brewing stand grow with your skills and equipment, but it easily knocks down for long-term storage or transport, too. The top-tier brewing stand from Blickman Engineering. Learn more at BlickmanEngineering.com and to find a local Blickman retailer and start brewing from the top tier.
Nico, listen, our lawyers said that we had to do this for 1 hour, and after this, we don't have to talk to each other for 3 more months until the next meeting.
Kids. Come on, let's get out of here.
I'm supposed to have more lines. I'm the professional. Hey, it's Sully.
And I'm Nico.
And we opened the 21st Amendment 10 years ago at 563 2nd Street in San Francisco, just 2 blocks from Giants Park, to make great beer and have a great time doing it.
That's right, because to us, the 21st Amendment is more than just the right to make beer. It's the right to experiment, to be innovative, and just do things differently. And so now, we're putting our craft beer in cans.
That's right, cans. You can find our world-famous Heller High Watermelon Wheat Beer at Brew for Your Die IPA in the Northeast, Northwest, parts of the Midwest, and Alaska in cans and on draft. So next time you're at your local neighborhood pub or good beer store, be sure to ask for 21st Amendment in cans.
Because everyone likes it in the can.
Tasty Crack Cans.
Tasty Crack Cans.
Williams Brewing is your online resource for prompt delivery of quality home brewing supplies. Since 1979, Williams Brewing has offered the finest equipment and freshest ingredients and the best customer service in the business. Cut hours off your brewing sessions by using one of our 11 varieties of famous Williams malt extract. Our Williams Belgian Pale Extract is mashed with pure Belgian two-row malt and a small percentage of Belgian wheat malt for an authentic Belgian character you just can't get from other extracts. Or check out our unique fermenters, 2.5-gallon kegs, paintball tank-based draft beer equipment, bottling aids, and much more. We even have our own line of precision hydrometers. Go to WilliamsBrewing.com to browse our vast selection. That's WilliamsBrewing.com. Orders placed by 3:30 p.m. Pacific time ship the same day. Brewing is easy. The Williams way.
This is www.thebrewingnetwork.com.
Sit down next to it, grab yourself a paper towel, and watch those yeast have sex.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to your hosts, Jamil Zainasheff and John Palmer. Putting the testicles in technical. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking building yeast library. And by no means is this, everything you need to know in order to do your own yeast library. That could take, years worth of shows.
Yeah.
But hopefully that gives you kind of an overview of the process, some ideas of the types of things you need to deal with and some of the things you need to think about as far as, what strains you would store and, things along that lines and, some of the information you need to kind of go further on your own. You could probably kind of piece it together from what we've given you, but I encourage you to do some research, online or, pick up some books. There are other books out there before, this yeast book that Chris and I worked on. You can pick up, I think, Pierre Rajot, Yeast Culturing something or other. It's not a great book, but it gave me enough information to get started many years ago. There's a lot of repetition in it, but it's still a decent book, well worth the money if you want to get started. And just a couple of good websites that do that. I just don't know what they are off the top of my head. And also, they're doing a Fungus Among Us book, which White Labs and Yusuf Chernay at
Ballast Point.
Yeah. Really nice guy, helped us out with Kenya Britt. Also did a lot of that book, and that's good information in there. And you can pick that up. I think More Beer still sells it. They kind of like retrieved it from the dead and fixed it up and been selling it. So that's a good one to get you started. Those two books right there should teach you most of what you need to do plating and slants and building it from there. When it gets into the freezing and stuff like that, long-term storage. Yeah, hey, this yeast book, that'll be your ticket right there, and I'll get my my nickel, there you go.
Yeah, we've needed a good comprehensive yeast book for home brewers,
mm-hmm.
and I think this one really fills the bill.
Yeah, you helped review and edit my crappy writing to make it a lot better.
Is it going to be worth Jamil's nickel, Palmer?
Oh, yeah.
Did he earn his nickel?
There you go. I think I earned my nickel. I do.
Good.
About a nickel. Maybe 4 cents.
This is no
rounding up. I'm rounding up.
This is no, quickly stapled together pamphlet or, loose leaf thing. This is going to be a book.
Oh.
It is a really useful book on yeast culturing, and it's going to be useful for both homebrewers and professional brewers.
Yeah. I see why it's not being published by the Brewing Network then. It's not just some stapled together.
It's practical information.
I see.
Yeah.
Good. Can't wait.
Good. Can't wait. Yeah. Yeah, I can see you're lining up to read that one. we'll put a copy next to the toilet for
this
you.
This is really
give one to chat for, you know, for
chat. Will read it. Chat will read it twice.
Chat will read it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Justin will tear pages out to use them when they're out of the toilet paper rolls.
Right. Or when I want to make myself feel smart.
By using it as toilet paper.
Yes. Osmosis.
Absorption through the anus.
That's right.
All right. So do you have any questions from the chat room?
Well, just one real question was coming through. A lot of people in there talking about this. But it was about, and you covered it a little bit. That guy, 314, is in the chat room, and he brought up about fermentations from frozen yeast. So after you've stored it and it's been frozen for a while, he had read on somebody's blog that that the yeast don't quite ferment right just after being frozen, that you sort of have to do a test batch or some sort of a buildup. So maybe just a little more elaboration on that.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think that applies actually to any storage and propagation from storage, right? So you're storing these cultures, and the longer you store them, the less they are apt to act like you want them to act when you start up again. So you really need to, you know, ideally you plate it out again, you pick pure colonies, you do a test batch and, you know, test ferment and see that they all, you know, ferment the same and that, you know, the flavor profile is correct, and you should be recording flavor profiles. And this is all, you know... So when you go out and you buy yourself a package of White Labs or Y yeast, and you're saying, oh, it's got to be pennies worth of yeast in here. Well, yes and no. You know, the packaging's expensive in order to be able to successfully ship the yeast and have it viable at your end. And, you know, the homebrew shop's got to make a little bit of money so they don't starve to death and close their doors. So... there's not a whole lot of, it's not like they're you know, they're riding around in private jets and stuff. There's a lot of labor that goes into maintaining those pure cultures and ensuring that, you know, again, the yeast you get is going to ferment the way that you expect it to ferment. And they're held to a pretty high standard. Anybody, you know, when the fermentation isn't right, they're the first ones that get the blame. And you know, When you're bringing these yeast back from storage, you really, you know, it depends on, you know, what kind of a risk taker you are. I'm actually pretty lazy. I know that you should do these test ferments. A lot of times I won't. I'll just grow it up and I'll just ferment something and then what the heck. Oh, maybe it'll be a joyous result. But if you don't go through these propagation steps and these test steps, yeah, you can end up with a problem.
So I guess, yeah, that was the question I was thinking of when you were talking about this. I mean, you do a test ferment. Well, is the yeast in the test ferment what you pitch to your real batch? Or are you kind of splitting it off at that point? Are you saying, okay, I got my main growth that I want to check, and you take a portion of that and do a test ferment. If that turns out okay, then you pitch the main amount that you held back.
Well, you know, commercially, that's probably what they would do. But in the homebrew type of environment, I would use that as a propagation step.
Okay. Yep. That's what I was kind of thinking, too.
Right. Now, I would not, get it stirred, and I wouldn't do all that. And I'd use I'd use around the same, starting gravity of the starter wort. But I would make it, you know, a little more beer-like and then taste it and say, okay, well, that, you know, that's good, and call that, part of a step and use that yeast off of that. If everything turned out perfectly off of that liter or two that you're doing, mm-hmm. of that beer that you're doing, and it tasted good, I'd go ahead and use that yeast.
Okay, I've got a question. I mean, we've talked, Jamil, about... you know, repitching yeast cakes and or reusing yeast. Say, you know, you buy your Y yeast or White Labs tube, and mm-hmm. you brew a batch of beer. And you've said in the past that it's almost not until the third repitch of that initial vial that you feel the yeast really hits its stride.
Right.
Does the same model apply here?
Yeah, and really, it's interesting. All these little propagation steps, people go, well, okay, there's one step. That should be, I'm repitching, one generation to the next. And it really doesn't work that way. It's, it has to be in, like full-scale batches of beer. That's really the only time it seems to have this effect. And, it's got to be your regular process, selection. Because sometimes you're leaving certain yeast behind, or you're collecting certain yeast, and the way you harvest and repitch, all that is affecting the ending outcome. And until you kind of do that a few times, it really doesn't. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And actually, somebody had a question of. If once I get it to that point, if I, plate that out, can I store that condition and that the yeast were in, and will they behave the same from pitch one? Once I get those yeast, no, because the whole storage and regrowing it
restarts the clock.
The,
huh?
The lab yeast is a lab propagation is completely different than a brewery. Propagation and brewery growth and reuse. It's a weird thing, but they're two totally different things. No matter how good the lab propagation is and how healthy, these yeast that white labs and white yeast provide to you, of the spectacular health and purity that they provide, it's not the yeast for, beer brewing. It is, but it isn't. It'll do great, but there's a subtle difference between that and once you've repitched several times.
Yeah. Okay.
It's interesting. A lot of these breweries, they will, they will do their first batch, and then they'll do another batch, or maybe three batches, and then they'll blend them in order to smooth out those differences when they get a new pitch from the lab, whether it's, white labs or white yeast or, their own in-house lab. Oftentimes they'll hold that batch and blend it to smooth out those subtle differences.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I think that was a good show. I think we covered a lot of interesting information, and Mr. Blickman at BlickmanEngineering.com got his money's worth today that he's supplying the show to you guys. And if you get a chance, go by BlickmanEngineering.com and check out all the fine goods I got there. I know I'm salivating over many of those cool things, and he's got some great things coming up too. And if you get a chance, come on out to the National Homebrewers Conference in Minneapolis. It's going to be a lot of fun. Blickman will be there. Palmer, you'll be there. I'll be there. Justin, the whole Brewing Network will be there, and we'll have a lot of fun. We'll drink a lot of beer.
If you haven't signed up yet, you should do it soon because they're already...
It'll sell out.
Yeah, it's already into the Overflow Hotel.
Yeah, it'll sell out. But go. It's well worth it. And make sure you get there a day early so you can attend the Brewing Network party. I'll be there. I'll be getting drunk. I'll be getting out of control.
Yeah.
And taking weird photos with people like the Woods.
Yeah.
then post on Facebook. I thought that was all personal between us, but apparently it wasn't.
Right.
Make sure you brew lots of beer and bring it with you. We'll enjoy tasting it. And until next time, make sure to brew strong.
Brew strong, everybody.